Федеральная служба безопасности отмечает столетие со дня образования.
100 лет этой государственной службы прошли
сначала
на страже...
Сначала ВЧК,
нет.
Затем НКВД, КГБ,
все
теперь
ГПУ,
ФСБ.
Все ГПУ, НКВД, КГБ и, наконец, нынешнее
Если
ФСБ.
Работает Лубянка, чтобы спокойно жить...
ВЧК, the GPU, the НКВД, the МГБ, the КГБ and the ФСБ. The Kremlin's secret police have gone by many names. In this week, they had a birthday. Throughout the year, Vladimir Putin's regime studiously avoided celebrating dates associated with the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. But the centenary of the founding of the CHK, the original Soviet-era secret police, was another story entirely. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there. Welcome from blighty Britain.
It's nice to have you from Britain. And joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU and co-author of the books The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB, and Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries. Welcome back, Andrei.
Yeah, hello.
Hello, good to have you. So it's not at all surprising that the 1917 centenary Vladimir Putin's Kremlin chose to mark was the December 20th founding of the CHK. Putin gave a speech in the Kremlin calling the CHK and its successors an inalienable part of Russia's history and said those who serve the secret police are true patriots and defenders of the state. But let's face it, he pretty much does this every year. But what was a bit surprising was an interview FSB director Alexander Bortnikov gave to Rossiyskaya Gazeta, the official Russian government newspaper, in which he offered a remarkable defense of the mass purges, forced deportations, and the Gulag system that cost millions of lives. The Stalinist purges, he said, had an objective side, and a significant number of criminal cases were based on factual evidence. You can tell a lot about the regime from the history they choose to highlight, and I cannot, of course, imagine Germany celebrating the founding of the Gestapo or justifying its activities. What did you make of all this, Mark? Putin's speech was pretty routine, but Bortnikov's interview was no accident. It was designed, I think, to send a message, no?
Actually, I think I probably flip it the other way around. Bortnikov doesn't speak publicly as often, no, absolutely. And his defense of the CHK was distasteful but predictable. And this whole business about, well, not all of the people who ended up being repressed in the Great Terror were innocent. It's a little bit sort of, apart from that, how did you enjoy the play, Mrs. Lincoln? But nonetheless, exactly. I mean, what else could you expect someone like him to say? For me, actually, I felt that it was the Putin speech that was more likely to be the one with the message. And the message in particular was that foreign agents, in the espionage rather than other sense, foreign agents are trying to intervene in our political system, and we must depend upon these great defenders of the motherland to protect us from their machinations. Firstly, because it essentially sets up one of his basic platforms, I think, for his presidential re-election, which is, these are dangerous times, everybody outside hates us, and therefore this is not the time to be tinkering with changes in the political system. But at the second time, it also clearly indicates that those people who are opposed to Putin, real opposition rather than the sort of the Zyuganovs of this world, are at best naive dupes of foreign spies and at worst actual agents.
Andrei, what are your thoughts? What was your takeaway from Putin's speech, the Bortnikov article, the fact that the Kremlin chose to mark this 1917 centenary while it ignored all of the other ones associated with that date?
Well, to me, it was a very significant message. I think it was a message from Putin. It was also the message from Mr. Bortnikov. And to be honest, everybody sort of expected them to deliver some sort of message because we are... Well, Vladimir Putin officially now running for the next president term, and he needed to give some message to the domestic audience. So he already did that for the foreign audience when he didn't encourage Russian outlets not to go to the Olympics, and everybody understood that he wanted to end this period of hostilities, if you can say that. So everybody expected him to say something about what will happen inside the country. And given the fact that he already, I would say 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, slightly changed it, or not slightly, not that slightly, but significantly changed the role for the FSB in the Russian society, making it much more instrumental in, say, trying to control the society, conducting selective repressions. So that's why it was important. And to be honest, it was quite interesting that both of them decided to talk about this Soviet experience. Mm-hmm. And remember that KGB was primarily, I mean, in the late 80s and 70s, we are not talking about Stalin now. But in the 80s, it was mostly about two things: how to control the population by spreading spy money and intimidating people, and how to control the elites by selective repressions. And that's exactly what's going on over the last 2 years, and that's exactly what the message of Bortnikov. I think the only thing he probably added by himself was this strange thing about Beria, which was absolutely surprising to me. He praised him maybe three times,
yes.
which is actually quite surprising. And I think it's really interesting because he praised him mostly for one thing, for stopping repressions against the agents of NKVD. So you immediately understand this idea of self-interest. Like, we praise this guy because he stopped attacking us.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably was the only thing he added by himself.
I mean, there were two parts to, I think, both Putin's speech and the Bortnikov interview in the Rossiyskaya Gazeta. And I want to kind of take them individually. One was the use of history. One was the selective use of history, and the other was kind of the role of the security services going forward. And I know, Andrei, you spoke about this in your interview with Current Time Television this week. Let's start with the use of history. One thing that struck me is contrasting both the Bortnikov interview and the Putin speech with Putin's remarks earlier this year at the Memorial to Victims of Repression. And remember, we spoke about that on this program, Mark. What does this tell you about the use of history? I mean, taking this all into account, the ignoring of the 1917 revolution for obvious reasons. The Russians don't want, the Kremlin doesn't want Russians thinking about the first colored revolution, if you will, in these times of rising discontent. But then the highlighting of this, contrasting that with the speech Putin gave, the surprising speech Putin gave at the Memorial to Victims of Repression. How do you read all of this, Mark?
Well, I mean, the first point to make is clearly that Putin is a politician, and therefore, to an extent, he will obviously say things depending on the nature of the audience, the nature of the event. He could hardly have gone along to the Memorial to Victims of Repression and said, yeah, but, you know, maybe 20% of these people, though, actually they weren't repressed, they were perfectly right. guilty, and let's go through. So, okay, we have to actually sort of insert that caveat. But more generally, I mean, I think what it says, obviously, this really illustrates the essentially self-interested, cherry-picking nature of Putin's sort of approach to history. It's not just do we only take the bits that we like, but it's also that we only shade them and colour them in ways that we like. And the key thing is, I mean, actually, Putin's approach to history is not about necessarily institutions. It's not about states. It's certainly not about conceptual ideologies. It's basically about state power. And it's this kind of teleological, weak history approach to how Russia becomes a great power, and therefore, by extension, how it deserves to continue to be a great power. And therefore, anything that advances that, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about the Battle of Kulikovo in 1380 or the victory of the Great Patriotic War in 1945. It doesn't matter if we're talking about those, the spooks who are an inalienable part of Russian history, which is actually depressingly true, or the industrialization of the state under Stalin, regardless of the cost, regardless of the inefficiencies. It is very much this sense of just basically he's looking to create a narrative of Russian great power status, and obviously using that as the locomotive to which he attaches the wagon of his own sort of political career. And in a way, it is, regardless of the costs, you know, Leningrad is Leningrad. St. Petersburg is St. Petersburg, but let no one worry about the bones of the serfs or the bones of the defenders on which it is buried. You look at the glories of the city instead.
So along that line of thinking, the ignoring of the rest of 1917 is a period, of course, when the Russian state was extremely weak and falling apart and crumbling. So that is something that is not to be celebrated, but to be ignored, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, Dzerzhinsky was an unpleasant man, but he was an efficient and ruthless one, and therefore that's okay. Kerensky may have had rather more going for him, but ultimately he was a loser, and therefore he shouldn't be there. Lenin ultimately was the one who sort of planted this mine beneath the sort of the Soviet state. It is very much about essentially picking the winners, picking the people who, in his mind, and again, you know, we've got to stress, this is Putin's notion of what makes a great power, which is nothing to do with its sort of power, force of example and so forth. It's about, you know, centralized control and military and imperial weight. Mm-hmm. Anything that contributes to that is okay in his book.
Mm-hmm. Andrei, I wanted to get your thoughts on this question as well, and also about this cult of the Czechist in the Russian imagination, which does very much exist and that this regime plays on very much.
Well, I think we need to remember that Putin is a trained KGB agent, and it means that he has a very strange perception of history, and especially of political crisis, especially in our country. And it means that usually these kind of people with this kind of mentality, they do not see economic, sociological, social reasons for political crisis. What they see in most cases, they see some hostile intervention from some forces from outside. And the problem is that if you have this kind of mentality, you have a big problem how to explain why, actually, in the 20th century, we have two big powers, enormous powers, very powerful countries, the Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union, destroyed by relatively small groups of people with some support from the West. Because actually, they see the history of the 20th century like that. They really believe that Tsarist Russia was destroyed by a small group of people, revolutionaries, and actually, if you watched this interesting movie we had just some weeks ago in Russia about Trotsky and Lenin, you immediately see that you really believe in this conspiracy theory. Mm. But it was about a very small group of people with some support from the German general staff. And exactly the same thing, problem they have with explaining the way the Soviet Union collapsed. Once again, a small group of people, they call them, and Bortnikov actually, he repeated this thing about agents of influence, right on the top of the Kremlin, probably with some support of the West, were somehow able to destroy this great, powerful system, given the fact that KGB was already there. So you need to explain these things, and they do not know how to explain it. I think Bortnikov's interview was an astonishing example how they still fail to explain this big problem and this political crisis, two political crises to themselves.
Mm-hmm. And the cult of the Czechist in the Russian popular imagination. Can you speak to that a bit? Because this is something that is incredibly enduring. What accounts for that, and how are they using it?
Well, I think they have very strange ideas about the history of their own security services. And because just remember how they tried to celebrate the history of the Russian foreign intelligence. They usually say something about patriotism. And Bortnikov actually repeated this thing in his interview. Agents of JK, OGPU, and KGB were, first of all, they were patriots. And then they needed to pick up someone to exemplify the hero of the Russian, of the Soviet intelligence. And for some strange reasons, they decided to pick up Kim Philby, who was not, after all, the Russian patriot. It was not about that. He was about something completely different. So they are struggling with there's a problem how to explain their history, given the fact that we need to get rid of any kind of ideology. And it's a big problem. You cannot just say, The Daisy Revolution started, all these revolutionaries just turned into big Russian patriots. It doesn't explain anything. Right. It doesn't work. Yeah.
Mark, what can you say about the cult of the cult of the Czechists in the popular imagination? Because it's something that does, they hit this note all the time for a reason. It works.
Yeah, I think we should note that in a lot of countries, there is a sort of a certain cult of their own intelligence agencies and so forth. I think obviously the key thing is that here the Czechists actively seek to cultivate it. And I think there's two things to be said about this. One is that the Czechists in their kind of historical trajectory used to be in Soviet times very much a tool of the party. There was a cult of them, but there was clearly this sense of ultimately, though, they were there for the party, they were subordinated to the party. Now, obviously, there is no more Communist Party. And so just as there is nothing now intervening, shall we say, between the spooks and power, you know, people like Patrushev and Bortnikov, you know, are very closely connected to Putin personally. Well, so too, in a way, that there's nothing kind of intellectually or ideologically between the Czechists and their own myth. So they are now in a position to basically shape their own myth as suits them and suits their vanity and suits their political needs. And we've got to realize that obviously they're all in a way struggling for their own power politically. And part of that is by having this kind of generic cult. But there's another point which I've been kind of grappling with in my own mind. How far is this genuinely a cult of the Czechist? I.e., that somehow sort of there is a sort of a certain popular sense that the Czechists are these, you know, valiant defenders and representatives of all that is great and wonderful about Russia. Or how far is it that in some ways the Czechists, the miscellaneous spooks, embody many of the kind of the basic values and operating system of modern Russia? Of, you know, concepts of power, concepts of interaction between people, an assumption that basically if you have power, of course, you will use it to feather your own nest, that it is somehow morally praiseworthy to be ruthless and focused and disciplined and power hungry rather than to be charitable and mild and meek and wait to inherit the earth. So I think that, you know, what we actually have is an intertwining of two things. A cult of the Czechist that is actively developed by the spooks for political and social reasons, but also the fact of actually, unfortunately, this is a nation of the Czechists. Mm-hmm. And in a way, they are in keeping with the values of Putinism. Mm.
I can't help but recall being in Moscow in the late 90s when there a lot of polling was being done about what kind of successor to Boris Yeltsin the Russian population wanted. And Putin wasn't chosen by accident. He was chosen because he fit that profile. Somebody who is young, had a security service background, was tough talking and so on. So this is something that was not, I mean, it was nurtured by the Putin regime, but it was there even in the so-called liberal 90s, wasn't it?
Exactly. But this is it. I mean, but Putinism is not, you know... Putinism is not something that Putin created right. out of whole cloth. Exactly. Putin is at once a symptom as he is also a creator. And in a way, the 1990s was this period of massive immiseration, chaos and lack of direction. And in that respect, someone like Putin is in some ways the anti-Yeltsin. The absolute sort of opposite. I mean, in fact, in practice, clearly, it's not as simple as that. There are certain ways in which they're very, very closely allied in terms of their sort of deinstitutionalization of the state and so forth. But, you know, in the popular imagination, someone like Putin is the anti-Yeltsin. And, you know, and therefore, unfortunately, even though Putin can no longer, for most Russians, meaningfully appeal to the 1990s and say, well, at least we're not there. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that is where we can see the roots of Putinism.
Now, another note I wanted to hit, as I indicated before we kind of shift to the second half and talk about what to expect next year, and it's a good segue, actually, is it came out of both Putin's speech and it came out of the Bortnikov article, the role of the security services going forward. Andrei, you had a really interesting interview on Current Time this week on this topic, and I think it's no accident that these things come out just as the election season's kicking off. And as they came out, a new bill is in the Duma that significantly expands the powers of the FSB over other law enforcement. If I understand the bill correctly, it gives the FSB investigative powers over other law enforcement organs and security service organs. Andre, what could you say about the messages we got this week with this anniversary, with Putin's speech, with Bortnikov's article about the role of the security services going forward as we enter a new political season?
Well, I think it's pretty clear now that the FSB is seen by Putin today as a pure instrument, and we need to forget about some ideas we had in the 1990s, that we have some fields between security services, we are sort of independent, we can promote their own interests, and so on and so forth. What we see now, that we see that Putin started he started with selective repressions, and he made sure to send this signal to everybody. And we are talking about bureaucracy, we are talking about ministries, and we are talking about the security services. He actually has sent this message to the investigative committee, and we got some people on the very top of this investigative committee arrested by the FSB. But we also have these repressions targeting people inside of the FSB. Actually, today we got an FSB general sent to jail for some crime, and it's a message. And it's a very Soviet message that, yes, you are an instrument now. You should help me to conduct selective repressions against my elites, but you cannot be immune, and you know that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a message for the FSB also. That's probably why Bortnikov wanted to add this element about Beria. Probably he's not that happy, but so many of his departments, we are not talking about some people, we are talking about many departments in the central apparatus of the FSB targeted by repressions. We are talking about the Information Security Center, we are talking about the Moscow Directorate, we are talking about Counterintelligence Service. Now there are some people who had something to do with special forces of the FSB. So in many departments, we see some repressions. And I think it's quite interesting. It's very aggressive, I would say. And unfortunately, I think that Putin we see that Putin completely abandoned the idea of the new nobility. I'm sorry to say that because you wrote
a book with that title, right?
Exactly. But what actually they meant when they were talking about the new nobility back in the early 2000s, they actually tried to combine two things. They tried to combine the idea of the Soviet powerful KGB, but gave it a new status, gave it new privileges and powers to be the real Russian elite, a kind of nobility. And it looks like Putin completely abandoned this idea. He doesn't want the FSB to be the new elites. I mean, in terms of people, that you always can go to the FSB and pick up new governors and to just appoint them, but to use them as a pure instrument to conduct selective repressions, and that's all.
This is interesting because I'm hearing two distinct things here. On one hand, it appears the FSB is winning its long battle to become the dominant security service. Putin's been always very careful to try to balance the security services. So on one hand, they're getting what they always wanted. But on the other hand, Putin's kind of knocking them down a peg at the same time, depriving them of this position of being the new nobility and keeping them on a short leash. Is that a correct interpretation of what you're saying, Andrei?
Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Mark, you watch these internal dynamics pretty closely as well. What would you say to that? And how do you interpret this new law this new bill that's working its way through the Duma now?
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, the law, as is so often the case in Russia, is a retrospective acknowledgement of reality more than something that is genuinely changing. I mean, we've already seen the extent to which key elements within particularly the Interior Ministry, while notionally within the Interior Ministry, in practice, the FSB exerts considerable influence over. The E-centers, the counter, you know, quote-unquote, extremism, in other words, tends to mean political repression, directorate, the most lucrative directorate of all, economic crimes, cybercrime, and so forth. I mean, these are areas which, even while within the NVD, the FSB clearly has considerable influence over what they do and who runs them. So we'll see that. But of course, at the same time, as well as being various cases and trials of people within the FSB, we also shouldn't forget the looming presence of the National Guard.
Right.
Whose existence is also, in some ways, once a snub to the Interior Ministry, but is increasingly, as it starts to argue that it needs an investigative and analytic capacity, moving, parking its tanks, so far only metaphorical, on Dzerzhinsky Square. So I think, again, this is the classic sort of thing. Actually, with Putin, he always does this, of gives with one hand and takes away with another, precisely to maintain that. Whatever else he's not very good at, Putin is quite good at power. And I think also this reflects, going back to the whole business of the new nobility. I think what we have seen, and this is something that's been taking place in other contexts over time, is shifting from the idea of the new nobility as a class to the new nobility as a court. In other words, instead of having a certain status because of the institution for which you worked, instead, it's actually all about relationship to Putin and, you might say, the mini Putins within the system. Mm-hmm. It's all about the increasingly personalized nature of this regime. And obviously, that's a sort of a very stark choice between organizing principles of where power resides. And I think what we've definitely seen is a decision that, no, power does not reside in being a spook or an oligarch or whatever. Power resides in personal relationships.
And this is consistent with what you were saying in your interview at Current Time, Andrei, about that the role of the FSB is to protect the regime. It's not to it's not to protect the state. It's not to be the nobility. It's to protect the regime, which means Putin personally and his closest associates, correct?
Oh, well, yeah, but surely we have to mention, though, that I mean, you're completely wrong, because Bortnikov said so. He said that the FSB is entirely apolitical and does not support, it operates entirely in line with the Constitution and does not support any specific political institution.
Mark, you're trolling us. I thought we were going to have a legitimate argument here. Go ahead, Andrei.
What I wanted to add, that we need to remember that it looks like we see the shift in tactics. Because one thing, if you try to control your society, your government, your bureaucracy by appointing right people to govern them, to rule them, and a completely different thing if you control them by having some people from the FSB collecting compromising stuff on them and then just using this information to pick up some examples and then to send them to jail. I think it's a kind of big shift. We have, how many governors we have now in jail? We have 5 governors in jail. Yeah. We have people prosecuting from ranging from theater directors to
the first minister since Beria.
Absolutely. And I think it's quite a significant shift in tactics and technologies the FSB is using, because it's not anymore about appointing the right guy to control some region. It's something else.
Now, there was another point you made, Andrei, that stuck with me, and this about this new bill working its way through the Duma, is that it grants the FSB additional investigative powers, which is something the FSB is not really known as an investigative body. Is this, how significant is this change?
I think it's quite important, because the investigative committee, the investigative department of the FSB, to be honest, they had some powers. It was always this thing in the Russian criminal court that the guy who discovered the crime can actually investigate it. And that was a kind of excuse for the FSB, for many security services, to launch investigations very far from their traditional area, doing things. I mean, you're supposed to be about counterintelligence, and you can do something about customs control or organized crimes. But now it's become much more apparent, and it looks like the investigative department of the FSB became much more important. And actually, it's quite interesting, because it's a combination with another thing which we need to remember. In almost every case we see now, we have people not just from the FSB, but from a very particular department of the FSB, the department which is in charge of protection of a constitutional order, which actually is the former FIB department in charge of prosecuting political dissidents. Oh, yeah. And it's quite interesting. We have these people in the case of Serebrennikov, a Russian theater director. We had these guys in some other cases, and it's really significant. It means that we are getting back to this Soviet experience, because these people, they have nothing to do, and I just wanted to stress this, they have nothing to do with investigating crimes. The FSB was always a combination of two things, a law enforcement agency, and in this capacity, we can investigate crimes. But they're also a counterintelligence agency, which means that they can do some counterintelligence activity for years, meaning all kinds of methods, from suppressing things, disrupting organizations, controlling things. And these guys from the Department of Protection of Constitutional Order, they're from this second side. They are not about prosecuting or investigating things. They are about controlling, disrupting, and that's a completely new level of control.
Mark, what do you agree that this change is significant in the increasing the FSB's investigative authority?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, actually, I personally would have put it in the way that the FSB is actually being a three-pronged rather than two-pronged. In the sense of you absolutely have the counterintelligence side of things, the true counterintelligence side of things, actually sort of identifying spies and similar threats. And then you also have the law enforcement side. And then I would say that you have the political enforcement side as a third element, because I think it has a very definite, distinct, different culture. Mm-hmm. Now, in a way, that's a slightly different route, but it comes to the same place as Andrei, because exactly, I think what it actually interestingly means is this is going to place more investigative capabilities and powers in the hands of people whose mindset is much more about, we know who our targets are, how can we get them, rather than, oh, I wonder who committed this particular offence. Uh-huh. So I think, first of all, yeah, absolutely, it is a worrying sign of an increase, you know, increasingly sort of a return to bad old habits, or as Bortnikov would probably say, them grand old traditions.
Right.
But at the same time, yeah, I mean, I think what it interestingly does represent is part of the overall internecine squabbles within the security apparatus. Because this is definitely moving into territory that once upon a time Bastrykin's investigatory committee was primarily tasked with.
Right, they were supposed to be the politics police.
Yeah, and it also is exactly at the time, as I said, the National Guard are busy talking about this. And although they often frame it as, well, you know, it's necessary for our job of enforcing gun control laws, for example, within Russia. You know, it's clear that they're not going to be building an investigatory and analytic capacity just to make sure that someone doesn't have three sawn-off shotguns somewhere in Irkutsk.
Right.
So it's interesting, I think again, the way that once upon a time, not too long ago, when Putin was very, very clearly using economic crime investigations as his instrument of choice for controlling the elite and harming people whom he wanted harmed, that's when you actually had turf wars erupting over who controlled as much as possible of the economic crime investigation capacities.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's interesting that you're actually getting turf wars taking place over really who gets control and has the largest share of political investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, given that these people probably know Putin's mind rather better than any of the three of us, I think it probably reflects a general mood that we're coming into a rougher period of Russian politics, alas.
Mm. Now, it wasn't that long ago that the three of us on this program discussed this idea that was floated to create this super ministry of state security, the MGB, which would have taken the Stalinist era name of the security service, one of the Stalinist era names of the security service. Is that dead now? Either of you, because I haven't seen much about it.
I think the name I think was always dead. I think not even the Putin regime would have been quite so audacious or clueless as to use MGB, even as a sort of little kind of
a nod and wink
warning sign. Yeah, no, but from what I've heard, the idea was never killed. It was once again shelved, but nonetheless, it's still sitting there on a shelf.
Absolutely.
So the question is whether it needs to be activated.
Mm-hmm. Andrei, you would agree?
Absolutely agree. I heard the same thing. It was never killed completely, so we can expect that someday it can emerge again if, say, Putin decides that it's a good idea. Probably the day would be different, and he still can use this committee of state security thing, and that's, to me, it's quite probable.
Uh-huh. So what would trigger something like this? Because it would kind of be a break for Putin. He's always chosen to kind of balance the security, to create one super ministry. Could be dangerous, no?
I don't think so, because actually, if you look at what Putin actually did with the FSB over the last 3 years, well, it's quite interesting, because we have been given some new powers, but at the same time, the personnel of the FSB was targeted. I mean, and they were the first targets of many, I would say, harsh measures Putin decided to use after the annexation of Crimea. All these things about how to ban people from having foreign accounts or foreign properties, these kind of things, some selective repressions against the generals and majors and colonels. Well, we see these things targeting the FSB and not a sign of dissent from Lubyanka. These people are quite loyal, and I think they would stay loyal. The thing is that actually, if we try to look at, and now we have this good excuse to do this, I mean, if you try to think about this historically, while actually the Russian security services, as well as the army, was always not very, I would say, capable of building underground horizontal structures. Well, probably Stalin did everything to suppress these things, but actually these people were absolutely incapable of doing anything like that. We didn't see any examples of any underground organizations inside and any kind of dissent inside.
Uh-huh. Anything to add, Mark?
I would agree, but I think the interesting thing is, and obviously this actually is giving you a free segue into the second part of the podcast when we sort of look forward. It's in some ways, as Putinism is currently constituted, I don't think there is any specific need for a security super ministry. However, one of the things we might well see is, particularly if he seeks to move away from day-to-day management of the economy and the sort of the whole, all the joys of manual control that implies, is actually an incentive to consolidate politics and political power in fewer institutions that he may actually be able to control directly or indirectly. So, I mean, I think the reason why the MGB, whatever we want to call it, project is still on the shelf, is because it is kind of part of the potential discussions, part of the potential thinking about actually how to reshape the political system in the future as it is. And given that that is still very much an open issue, that's why so too is this.
Yeah, no, that is question number one going into next year. So thanks for the segue, Mark. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion. And since this is the last podcast of 2017, take a look ahead to what to expect next year. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Void, Russia's Super Mafia. And joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura Ru, and co-author of the books The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB, and Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and New Online Revolutionaries. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Список Магнитского стал глобальным. Теперь он
США
включает
ввели санкции в отношении сына генпрокурора России.
Артем Чайка, сын генпрокурора России.
Дата проведения выборов президента
18 марта 2018 года. Выборы президента Российской Федерации.
So 2017 is just about behind us, and 2018 is just about upon us. Potential new U.S. sanctions loom in February. A presidential election, of course, awaits us in March. In the new year, Russia is clearly entering a new political season. Mark, you recently wrote a piece saying that the verdict in the Alexei Ulyukayev corruption trial signified the beginning of the end of Putinism, if I'm not misquoting you. What are you looking for in 2018 in the big picture?
Yes, well, I don't actually think we'll see the end of Putinism in 2018.
No, no, you did not write that. Exactly.
I know. No, I mean, I think you know, we are entering this kind of ancien regime phase with a certain degree of sort of decay and decadence about it, which doesn't mean to say that it won't be able to sort of act with vigor and spite when it chooses to. No, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that obviously we look to the election and we tend to automatically assume that the election means something, when on one level it really doesn't. But nonetheless, I think precisely because of a whole series of expectations that we built up, in some ways 2018, Putin is going to have to make some kind of decision, even if his decision is to do nothing different. That will in itself be an active decision. But I think we're going to see questions about who's going to be prime minister. I think that is going to be an interesting one. Is he going to stay with Medvedev, you know, the least worst option, or is he going to try something different? Is there going to be any further talk about constitutional change? I think this is one of the interesting things. Not, as some have said, about changing the structure of, you know, the federal units and so forth, but this whole business about whether or not some kind of new institutional basis can be provided for Putin to have some kind of super presidential role, which actually takes him out of day-to-day management of the country, but nonetheless gives him the status and the security that he really craves. And a sort of third intertwined element is precisely about the de facto structuring of the government. In some ways, we're interestingly heading towards a system where, in a way, there are four primary or potential primary nodes of power. There is the presidential administration that is clearly the sort of the crucial day-to-day political management institution. There is potentially the Ministry of State Security or something else. But anyway, nonetheless, you know, there is the political repressive apparatus. There is the military, which also has a sort of particularly important foreign policy role. And then in many ways, we actually have the cabinet of ministers, which is really nowadays more than anything else about social and economic governance of the country. And in some ways, those are the sort of the four bases. The question is whether we see those actually increasingly being sort of identified as the sort of the four pillars on which Putin's throne rests. So I think these are all interconnected, the prime minister, the constitution, and the political structure. And either Putin starts to show signs that he's moving towards some kind of change, or that he wishes to, and we'll often see this precisely in debate that isn't overtly coming from Putin, but from which he will then reach down and pluck the ideas that he likes.
Right.
Or does he actually just simply decide that he doesn't know what to do, doesn't know what's the best thing to do, isn't quite sure, in which case I think he really will quite quickly start hemorrhaging authority.
No, I picking up on that, Mark, I mean, I agree with you, but I see a series of micro questions, some related to the election. How are they going to handle Navalny in this election, whether or not he's on the ballot? What role are they going to let Sobchak play? Who's going to be the prime minister after the election? What's going to be done with the structure of the government? Things, all of these micro questions. But I think these all, what will happen with the security services, as we discussed in the first half. But these all feed into a much, much larger question. And I refer back to a piece Gleb Pavlovsky wrote a couple of weeks back on the Carnegie Moscow website, where he basically said in the coming years, we're going to see the start of the negotiations about what the Russian political system is going to look like. And part of this, it's true, is about preserving some post-presidential, extra-presidential role for Putin. But he said it goes beyond that. It's not just about one tired old man, because the system wants to preserve itself. And that may or may not become more important than the body, so to speak, than Putin, the man himself. So we're about to enter this period of negotiations. And as we know, negotiations in Russia can get pretty turbulent and sometimes violent. So I think the thing I'm really watching for going forward is what these negotiations are going to look like. Andrei, you've been listening. What are you looking for in the coming year? What are you watching for? What are you expecting?
Well, I would say two things. The first one is more tactical. It's all about the election. I don't quite understand it. That makes me really worried why people in the Kremlin seems to be so nervous about the coming elections. Mm-hmm. We just got these comments from Kirienko talking about some interference from the West and probably from the United States that he expects to happen. And they have all this new legislation proposed, for mm-hmm. example, targeting physical people, just people trying to brand them as foreign agents, which is absolutely, now it's just insane. I think it's really dangerous.
Andrei, do you think that's real fear, or do you think that is just kind of for domestic consumption to create an atmosphere?
I think it's a real fear. I know from my sources that people are really, really nervous. So they nervously react to anything. People write something, and the reaction is always extremely nervous. And it's quite interesting because it's not only about things in Moscow. It's about regions. It's about Poland. It's about social economic situation. It's about almost everything. Almost everything makes people very nervous, and I don't quite understand why. But even if you do not know the reason, it's not a very good thing and not a very good sign. But the second thing is much more strategic, and to be honest, that makes me really depressive. We do not understand how huge the military-industrial complex became over the last 4, 5, 6 years, and it's such a big thing now, and it's not only about people and institutions and plans working directly for the military-industrial complex. It's about many industries. It's about many oligarchs. It's about the IT industry. A lot of these people they're given some contracts by the Russian military complex, and the thing about it, why it's so important, and I think we do not understand the importance yet, is that it's completely changing the language we talk. It changes the mentality. All of a sudden, we hear people using Soviet terminology, how they describe their relations with the authorities. All of a sudden, people suddenly just understood, remember all these things about the need of secrecy. You talk to some IT people, and they became much more secretive. You talk to some metallurgical companies, and they became much more secretive because they remember everything about military Priyomka, all these things. All of a sudden, all these wars are back, and I think it's actually changed the political culture in the country in a way, because it's about so many people, it's about so many industries, it's about so many businesses, and it also means that some people with some very strange ideas about how to govern the country, they became much more powerful. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about people who actually have sell arms, who produce arms. It's all about that. And they have very special kind of mentality. In this picture, when we talk about who's the next prime minister, these people are missed in the picture. And probably it's time to start thinking about these people.
That's interesting. So we have fear, we have secrecy, we have a increasing power of the military-industrial complex. This is a great opportunity to kind of bring everything full circle from where we began our discussion. And Mark, also, what are your thoughts on my playing off of Pavlovsky, that the Putin the man and Putin the system are kind of becoming disconnected? What would you say to that?
Well, yeah, except, of course, that Putin still has and will continue to have considerable sort of personal power. And you know, the more he sees that gap opening, it raises questions of quite what he's going to do. Now, again, you know, here's always the danger, but you know, I can't help but think of the last years of Stalinism, when actually Stalin himself had come to realize that through these basically the bonds largely that had been created during the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, that the party elite were increasingly self-confident, increasingly making their own deals and not necessarily feeling they needed to constantly look to him. And that, therefore, he was probably preparing for a new round of purges. We've already had the doctor's plot, the Zhdanovshchina, and so forth. I think in that context, I mean, obviously, this is a very different kind of political system. But the question is, you might say, whether or not this is a consensual separation of Putinism and Putin. You know, because I mean, I'm sure on one level, I'm sure he would love to be able to divorce himself from that, and exactly just simply sort of, you know, enjoy life while a Putinist system operated beneath him and to his advantage. So, you know, is it something that works with the grain, or is it something that actually Putin then gets to feel nervous about and worried about, and therefore will exactly look for allies and look for institutions and means of reintegrating the two? So, yes, I think we will see negotiations. But to be honest, I think certainly at the moment, I expect that people will be trying to work with Putin rather than against him. And in this context, because exactly they do feel at risk. And I wanted to pick up on the nervousness point that Andrei made, which I think was absolutely right. But I think actually, in some ways, I feel that, Andrei, you actually gave the answer to that in the first part of the podcast, when you talk about the way that the Czechists look at 1917 through their own kind of particular prism, and they see it as a small group of people, what they can achieve when they are conspiratorial and backed by nasty outside powers. Because I think this is it. You know, it's not just the people who carry intelligence ID cards who think in these terms. It's a much wider proportion of the elite who exactly see this in the world in these incredibly conspiratorial terms. And if that's the way you think about the world, when you also look at the other sort of indices of trouble for this regime, increasing levels of industrial and social protest, dissatisfaction with worsening quality of life,
bank
all
failures.
These kinds of things. Yeah, you know, all of these things. And if you are geared to thinking that bad things happen because someone is doing them to you, you are, of course, going to be thinking, oh, my God, you know, not only are we facing this terrible campaign of destabilization, this Gibridnaya Vojna, but at the same time, we can't even find the bastards who are doing it to us. So we have to be looking more deeply. We have to have more investigators. We have to give more powers to the security apparatus, because it just shows how pernicious our enemies are. So I think this has become almost a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the sense of actually they're determined that the world is this hostile place, and therefore they find evidence for that to be the case.
Yeah, no, Mark, I think it's interesting you raise Stalin, and necessary caveat, yes, this is not Stalinism, but the system's not been this centralized since Stalin. And I think I read a piece in The Guardian this morning about how people in Moscow are not amused by the new film, The Death of Stalin, that I'm really eager to see once it finally hits the
screen. It's great. I saw it yesterday.
You saw it. I'm jealous. I can't wait to see it. I'm going to try to get it over the holidays. But, I mean, this is something we need to look to, because this is the last time you had a transition like this was then, right? So I think the death of Stalin in a lot of ways is very illustrative. And there's probably a reason why that film is striking a chord in Russia right now. And it's not a very happy chord.
Can I add one point to that, which again links into something that was said earlier about Beria and, you know, Botnikov's repeated sort of invocations of Beria also. Because if you think about it, I mean, actually, precisely, Beria was this phenomenally awful, vicious secret police chief, who nonetheless, when he was sort of scrabbling for power after Stalin's death, was the guy who basically was the most ardent advocate for scaling down the repressions, letting people out of the gulags and such. Right now, this is not clearly because actually he had a moment of being born again, humane, or indeed human. No, it was that in some ways this was just what was the most pragmatic, ruthless piece of self-interested politics that he'll come up with at the time.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, and again, I don't think they're doing so deliberately and consciously, but in some ways, when the Bortnikovs of this world invoke Beria, it is precisely because on some level they do actually respond to this sense of Beria. Unlike Ian Felix Zhezhinsky, Beria didn't care for one moment what the cause was. This was a route to power, self-gratification, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he took it absolutely. And that is, in many ways, unfortunately, the icon of today's Putinist elite.
Mm. Well, on that happy note, unless anybody has anything to add before we finish, we'll wrap it up. Speak now or forever hold your peace. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. I'm very much looking forward to that. And joining us from Moscow. Also via Skype has been Andrei Soldatov, co-founder of the investigative website Agentura RU, and co-author of the excellent books The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB, and Red Web, The Struggle Between Russia's Digital Dictators and the New Online Revolutionaries. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Always good to spread Christmas cheer.
Always good. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Happy winter holidays, everybody. We'll be off next week, and join us again next year. And now, until then, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noise MC.